Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdrauber. On today's show, regulating space. How does regulation work beyond the Earth's atmosphere? Who gets to regulate the universe? Joining me to discuss this are Aaron Osterley, Policy Director at the Space Frontier Foundation, and Cody Knipfer, Corporate Secretary at the Space Frontier Foundation. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having us.
So let's go back to the beginning. How has commercial space flight been regulated over the years? And just for listeners, we're talking about private sector space stuff. We're not talking about NASA, which is its own can of worms.
Right.
But how has the private sector that deals in space, companies like SpaceX, how have they been regulated since, 1984?
So actually, it goes back a little bit before 1984. There was a group that was developing what was called the Conestoga rocket, and it was really kind of the first attempt at private space launch. And at that time, it was one of those things, it's brand new. Nobody quite knows how to manage these kind of things. And for lack of a better phrase, long story short, they basically figured out they needed 16 different agencies to provide a stamp of approval before they could launch. And this group went out and got 16 stamps of approval from all these agencies. And they did launch a few rockets. They weren't successful, unfortunately, but it was, they went through and did all the legwork, and it was actually really impressive. And unfortunately, I don't remember their name right now.
Can you name all 16 agencies, or would that be a waste of time?
No.
And that's a huge compliance cost.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So as a result of this, what came out was what was called the Commercial Space Launch Act. And it basically said, we're going to take all these items and we're going to focus it all down into the Office of Commercial Space Transportation, which was originally under the Secretary of the Department of Transportation. Since then, it's been moved under the auspices of the Federal Aviation Administration, and they're in charge of initially then launching. They provide launch licenses, and for your launch license, you basically have to prove that you're not going to injure or damage the uninvolved public. You have to present that you have insurance if something goes wrong. One of the big items actually in all this is the insurance issue. Mm-hmm. Really bad. I mean, when rockets blow up, it can be a really bad day, obviously. Not just for the guys who have the satellites, but I mean, heaven forbid something really bad were to happen and you hit a populated area. And you may remember this better than I, since there was actually a really tragic accident back in the 70s, I believe it was, where an aviation case, but this guy had a high performance airplane, a military, like an F-104. It was a former military aircraft, and slammed it into a school. Right. And 16 kids died in that. Imagine that scaled up with a rocket.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, so these things that apply to commercial space flight, like insurance problems, like proving that your rocket's not going to blow up and fall, debris going to fall over everyone, doing it in a safe place, all that stuff. How is that? Are these regulations also the same for NASA and government spaceflight, or is it different because ostensibly astronauts know the risks? There's waivers that are signed. I mean, contrast the commercial space regulation regime with what we had with NASA up until maybe recently. Things have changed. Is there a difference?
So there's a lot of this falls down from treaty obligations, the Outer Space Treaty. It basically says a state is responsible for their activities, and if they damage another state's property, they're responsible. There was a famous case, in fact, where a piece of nuclear powered satellite crashed into Canada, and also when Skylab came down and caused damage in Australia, because the Outer Space Treaty requires you to pay for damages. They in both cases, damages were collected, not substantial, but it was a little bit of money.
And what was the Outer Space Treaty trying to accomplish? That was between the United States and the Soviet Union, right?
It's more than just, a majority of countries.
Are signatories, that's right.
Yeah, it's through the UN, and a majority of countries are, I mean, The Soviet Union and in the United States were the big ones.
Right. It was signed during the space race, at the height of the space race. And it was really an attempt between the United States and the Soviet Union to lay the rules, if you will, for how they were going to go forward in outer space. You know, because neither country, in their pursuit for space supremacy, if you will, wanted to leave the playing field open for bad application of outer space.
And there was substantial concern, I believe, at the time of getting into for lack of a better phrase, a territory fight.
Right.
On a grand scale in terms of how much investment was going to require. So that was one of the big impetus or big reasons they put together the Outer Space Treaty.
So you talked about the 16 agencies that was pre-1984. Then we had the 1984 Commercial Space Launch Act. Then we had 2004, these rules about passenger safety and information. Let's talk about what happened recently.
Well, let's go back a little bit to 2004 because there's an important point in there.
Oh, okay.
So back in, prior to 2004, there was a, there was no assumption of flying people. It was not part of the regs. It was, again, it was one of those situations where nobody's thought about it because for a long time it was always going to be NASA. And all of a sudden you had the rise of the Ansari X Prize.
Right.
And we were going to fly, and all of a sudden people were saying we're going to start flying people. It wasn't just, we'll fly people someday. Here's a spacecraft. Three people can fit into it. Three people can fly up.
Anyone.
So, you know, you have to figure out some way to provide, on some level, you've got to ensure that you're protecting the uninvolved public. So how do you do that? And what eventually came out was the Commercial Space Launch Amendments Act, which was an addition, obviously, to the original CSLA. And what they did is, they gave a lot of room and latitude for companies to try things out. There's a whole process for how you can test your vehicle substantially. Because again, one of these issues is we've never flown vehicles like this before. A lot of our rockets have been derived from ICBMs and weapon systems. You use a weapon system not all weapons, but like a missile you fire and you forget.
Because much of the space race was driven by weaponization.
Exactly.
The goal was to weaponize space, whereas now this conversation, we're talking about regulating commercial space, which is about hobbyists, but also about money and mining and things like that. The incentives have changed and the goals have changed.
And
so naturally the equipment has changed.
Exactly. So instead of using a rocket one time and throwing it away, you're talking about using something many more times. You know, to borrow a little from NASA, there was always the dream of what the space shuttle was going to be and it never was successful. But now, you know, but the goal is to figure out a way. How do you, if I want to fly a spacecraft, you know, four times a day, but if I want to find it 10 times a day, you're talking about a very different spacecraft than we have now. So, and that's where the commercial space launch, it was the, you know, we're going to create a way for you to do rigorous testing. And, you know, the key thing was they kept the kind of general idea of we're going to protect the uninvolved public, you know, and we need to ensure everybody's informed of the risks. But beyond that, it's kind of there's a lot of latitude, and because the assumption was this is not a common carrier. You know, you want to fly to Orlando or wherever on vacation, you're assuming a safe flight. This is risky, and we all understand that. You know,
now of course there's the basic issues of safety and protecting the uninvolved public. Those are obvious areas where there's a government role. Even if you're a staunch libertarian, you could probably see that a rocket blowing up and hurting a bunch of people should have somehow been prevented. But what are some of the other issues beyond safety? What are some of the regulatory challenges about just how commercial space operates? And what are some of the big debates that are happening now in the United States with other countries? Where are the fault lines?
You want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, a big one right now is this concept of mission authorization. And I'm hopefully not straying too much. Okay. Big concept is mission authorization right now. Article 6 of the Outer Space Treaty, which we talked about earlier, specifies that states must continually supervise the activities of non-state actors who are conducting activity in outer space. So how do you supervise the activity of a company that's trying to go out and mine an asteroid or land on the moon or do other sort of non-traditional space applications?
I want to put a space station up. How do you ensure you're not causing a huge debris cloud that'll destroy CommSats or something?
Right.
Like
Right.
And so while there are licensing procedures that have been laid in place because of these past laws that established them, there hasn't been any process through which the United States government can authoritatively say, yes, we are monitoring these companies, we've authorized their activity, and prove to the international community that the United States is still upholding its treaty obligations. Because as we said in the Outer Space Treaty, states are the actors that are supposed to monitor and uphold the obligations, even if it's private companies within those states that are actually conducting the activity.
Right. And isn't this kind of counterintuitive? Because one of the assumptions I had when starting to plan this podcast was that because of budget cuts to NASA and just the way that the industry is going, that kind of the whole point of privatization of spaceflight is that the companies are going to be taking over.
You're actually hitting on another key area, which is there is there are certain rationale and reasons for doing activities in space, and some of those have been challenged. Some of those are actively being discussed and challenged. What's the value in actually having humans in space? It's a question worth asking and understanding, because it's far too easy to fall into the trap of, oh well, it's wonderful and it's exciting and we're inspiration and it doesn't, you know. I'm not a hardcore libertarian by any stretch of the imagination, but I can absolutely respect somebody saying, why am I spending my money on this thing? So
if you don't mind to answer the question though, even though NASA might not be playing as big a role in the broader space activities that occur in the future, that doesn't mean that companies in the United States aren't still beholden to the rules of the game.
Right.
We signed a treaty that laid out obligations that the United States and the actors within the United States need to uphold when they're conducting spaceflight. And so even if it isn't a federal agency, a civil space program that's conducting these activities, you still have to uphold your burdens and your obligations. And so because of that, we need to develop regulatory procedures or at least methods by which the government can assure the international community that, don't worry, guys, we're still being a good faith actor and we're still doing what we need to do per our treaty language and agreement when it comes to space, even if it's the likes of a planetary resources mining an asteroid or a Bigelow habitat flying in orbit around the Earth.
Now, does this bring up a competitive problem? Because if NASA is increasingly scaling back its launches and its involvement directly in space and ceding that ground to the private sector, but the government is still overseeing the private sector as required by treaty, is there an anti-competitive issue if the government is competing with the private sector and also in charge of regulating the private sector? Who gets contracts? Is it the private guy? Is it NASA? You could see how there's a kind of conflict of interest there if the government is regulating its competitors.
It really depends. That's actually a major issue in terms of, you have, that's one of the biggest areas of discussion on that has been NOAA, actually.
And that's, just spell out our acronyms.
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They're responsible for doing a lot of remote sensing, a lot of, taking pictures, understanding what's going on in the oceans and so on and so forth. And one of the big areas of growth within the industry has been these small little satellites. They're about the size of like a loaf of bread called CubeSats. And companies are putting up 50, hundreds of to 100 of these things to provide continuous, all the time coverage of whole sections of the planet. And there's massive market opportunities and growth here. Planet Labs, do you remember how much they've gotten? They're like in the hundreds of millions of dollars they've raised, kind of a thing. And so they're out there doing these kind of things. And there's been some real concern because NOAA, who formally provides, that's one of the other agencies that does regulations. They regulate if you want to look at the Earth. They regulate how, if you want to look at the Earth, they also manage the Landsat program, which is a government program to also do remote sensing. So this has been an ongoing discussion of how do is it really necessary to have these massive Landsat satellites when the private sector is stepping up and doing some very innovative things.
I think it's important for us first to lay out this consideration, though. When we talk about regulation, oftentimes it's could be considered a dirty word for people in industry, right? A lot of burdensome rules that they have to follow, that they're going to have to pour money into meeting. An important thing about the commercial spaceflight industry and its regulations that the FAA AST, the Office of Commercial Space Transportation, is supposed to ensure public safety through this stuff. But its other mandated mission is to foster the commercial space industry. So these regulations often come with the lightest touch possible that they ensure.
When it's the AST.
When it's the AST. Granted.
Let's be clear, because there can be multiple agencies in play here.
Granted. But for the AST, a lot of the work that goes into it is ensuring that these regulations aren't providing an undue burden upon these companies. And so speaking to the point of, isn't there competition between the government now and the private sector if the government is, you know, also regulating these industries? And I don't necessarily see it as competition, but rather as an opportunity for expanded collaboration. The government is a lot of champions of commercial space, both in the industry, in agencies, and in Congress, are trying to help foster this burgeoning industry.
I also think that the other side of this coin, though, you have to remember is you have multiple agencies. So whereas AST is doing a lot of, is very agreeable, there are other, you know, and it's not, and again, even within agencies, it's not, you have variation. But, you know, there's been a recent issue, this has come up in just the last year. There are a whole bunch of old ICBM motors that are out there.
Intercontinental ballistic missile.
Yeah, my apologies.
No worries.
But there's a whole host of these rocket motors that were used for missiles, and they're just sitting around, and basic, for lack of a better phrase, they go bad after so long because the fuel in them goes bad. And there's been a proposal to go and basically give or sell, depending on how the deal would be structured, to a company, and so that company could go launch at a much cheaper price. Well, there's a whole bunch of people who are working on their rockets that could address this issue, and they've gone out and raised money in the private markets. So, you know, in this whole situation, the DoD is not the guys who are going to do the regulating, but this has the potential to definitely provide, you know, an unfair competitive advantage. So there's tension within the government and but sometimes between agencies and a little bit within agencies.
Are there proactive steps that you could identify, specific things that, let's say, for hypothetical purposes, both of you are in positions of power, you are the chairman of the FAA or the AST or whatever, and you can pull policy levers that you think would be beneficial to solving some of the problems that we've identified here today? What would you do?
I'll let you go first.
Well, I know a concern among especially launch companies in the United States right now is that the AST isn't exactly the fastest agency in reviewing regulations and, you know, propagating regulation. And so there needs to be a streamlining process, because we're now at a point where technology and capability is advancing far faster than the regulations and the policies that are in place.
Are you suggesting that the marketplace and innovators and entrepreneurs are moving at a faster pace than a bureaucracy?
It's pretty remarkable, I know.
Have you been listening to this podcast?
And AST as an office in the FAA has long struggled with constrained resources. We're starting to see now in some proposed bills and language increased funding for AST, which might go toward this end. But it's long been a challenge for this office to keep up with the work that's being done in the industry. So if I was a policymaker or a person with some leverage, I would try to find better methods, either through allocation of resources or prioritization, to create a regulatory framework that's light, has a light touch, but also current and stays up to date with the developments in the commercial space sector. Because space only happens. There's all this great technology, all this great engineering, great science, brilliant minds. But ultimately, all of this only happens at the pace through which policy, law, and regulation will allow it.
So I would, I actually think it's worth stepping back and asking, what do we want? I mean, there's, you know, if I have a $1 billion, I have no, you know, I can go and spend that $1 billion however I want. And we have lots of examples of that. But I also think that there's something to be said of there are strategic needs that we potentially want or would be good for us with when it comes to the issue of space. And I would like to have at a minimum, I'd like to see that discussion happen, because frequently I don't feel like that discussion happens.
What are the strategic needs?
I would argue that the values that are core to how we've structured our country in terms of, you know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and those kind of things, are values we want to spread.
Right.
And I include spreading that into the cosmos. I have no problem if China wants to go to the moon, but I don't want them the only ones there. I want to see the values that, you know, are part of our country and part of our beliefs be part of the cosmos. So I think there's a strong argument made that there's a strategic case that we want to be doing active things in space. And I mean, you can talk about other aspects as well in terms of, you know, we want to ensure we have capabilities for the warfighter when they're doing boots on the ground somewhere. We want to ensure that we're not going to destroy low Earth orbit so people can't do things there. I mean,
right.
Most people have seen the movie Gravity. Now that's a little bit of a hand wavy stuff, but there's some real potential there for that kind of a thing to become a real problem. So there's strategic reasons for us doing stuff in space, but we tend to lose those strategic reasons when we have policy discussions. That's where, you know, then you'll see programs get created within NASA, within AST, within different agencies, within the DOD that don't serve a national interest. I would frankly like to have a long and hard discussion about what is a real strategic interest. I'll give you a really powerful example. Right now, there's a program that DOD is doing called Access One. And the purpose of it is to develop much cheaper launch vehicles, substantially cheaper launch vehicles. It's really a pretty great idea, because there's a lot of stuff going on. You have SpaceX doing its flights, you have Blue Origin doing its flights, a company called Mastin just announced some vehicles it's working on, and there's like two or three others that are either public or that aren't being announced yet that are all working on this kind of thing. And it's great to see this kind of, you know, having cheap access would be incredible, both from a warfighter front, from a strategic defense front, from an economic front. This is something that is worth investing in versus other programs that aren't delivering on things.
And I think what Aaron's speaking about also speaks to an earlier question of yours about the competition between the government and the private sector. Yeah. And as I said earlier, I don't necessarily see it all as competition. There's great overlap here. If the private sector can develop vehicles that can cheaply and quickly access space and be reused, then that provides a platform that the government can purchase contracted services to launch its own stuff into space.
Well, I was going to ask about public-private partnerships. So there's an example, you brought up one where the private sector develops the equipment and then sells it to the government. Are there other opportunities for public-private partnerships that you see in this space? And just pointing out that this is a unique industry.
Absolutely.
So there are a lot of industries, and we talk about on this show, things like government-run broadband that make us squeamish as libertarians, but there's an obvious role for government when it comes to space,
right?
Because of the Outer Space Treaty, because the industry was basically started by
and
the
space
government.
Space is hard. Right. You need the help.
So what, other than just basic selling equipment, are there other things that the government could cooperate with private industry on that you would support?
I actually think the most interesting one is the space station. We have a space station that, depending on who you want to talk to, we've spent somewhere between $50 and $100 billion.
Probably. This is the International Space Station.
Yeah, the International Space Station that's up there right now that Chris Hadfield was on, that everybody who saw the guitar playing video, that's the space station. We've spent a substantial amount of money on it. You can argue whether that was as efficient as it was or not. But to a certain degree, it's been spent. Sunk cost. Is there something of value we can do with it that makes it worthwhile to keep it going? And I honestly see some really exciting potential in terms of public-private partnerships for it that would allow for the creation of a whole new marketplace. The most obvious example is what happened really recent, and within, is it 2 weeks ago, Cody?
Beam?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The a company called Bigelow Aerospace, they're working on space station. They want to build their own space station, basically. They're funded by Robert Bigelow. He's the Vegas hotel magnate. They put up a small module onto the ISS and attached it, and it was last month that they attached it, and then a couple of weeks ago they inflated it, and just recently, like in the last few days, people actually went inside of it for the first time. Now this is a small module. You have to understand it's about maybe the size of a mini, the mini car, but it's a test bed. And I could absolutely see them scaling up to another module that gets attached that expands the laboratory capabilities of the space station, or expands the habitability of the space station, all those kind of things.
You know, and so NASA isn't just disappointed in this day and age. NASA has a roadmap and a plan to go to Mars. And there's a lot of people who argue for it and a lot of people who argue against it. But at any rate, this is the plan that NASA's locked in on. Well, if NASA's going to Mars, then they'll be leaving a lot of low Earth orbit behind. The ISS is scheduled to be decommissioned in the mid-2020s, 2024 right now, in law. What happens after the ISS goes down? If NASA's going to Mars, do we just abandon low Earth orbit and human spaceflight in low Earth orbit? You know, there's this gap that we're anticipating. It's a gap somewhat akin to what happened after the space shuttle was decommissioned in 2011. You know, we're still trying to work on returning indigenous human spaceflight launch capability to America. And so there's a real opportunity for public-private partnerships, or the fostering of an industry through public-private partnerships such as Beam, to fill the gap that happens after the International Space Station comes down. You know, if Bigelow is successful with Beam and follow-on applications, expanding a bigger habitat on the ISS, for example, then you could create and demonstrate and prove a market for space stations in low Earth orbit after the ISS is gone, which either NASA could fly to or that private customers could fly to, and retain the American presence in low Earth orbit.
And we talked earlier, I'd like to close on the issue of Russia, because we talked earlier about how important the Cold War was to developing space. And a lot of it was driven by a desire to weaponize space, or to beat the Russians there, or to protect ourselves against potential attacks from space. And now we're talking about much more of a profit-driven, or just kind of curiosity-driven environment. You hear a lot in the news about how, oh, NASA's going away, and you know, you've debunked a little bit of that, but there's this general sense that there's budget cuts, they're shutting down, the last shuttle is a very emotional moment in Florida, you know, I watched it. And now we hear stories about Russia is the only game in space.
Right.
People can spend, Russia upcharges people millions of dollars to go to space. What is the role for Russia? How does it relate to the United States? How do you see this relationship evolving beyond what it used to be, which was an arms race?
I think you have to start by understanding it's not going to be the U.S.-Russia relationship within space is going to in part be dictated by the broader U.S.-Russian relationship. Example being, the Crimean War has had it's caused a whole bunch of discussions about what we can and can't do with regards to Russia. At one point, there was discussion: can we actually continue to fly our astronauts on their vehicles? There has been a long discussion about the RD-180. It's an engine that is on the Atlas rocket. It's manufactured by Russian companies, and we use it for a lot of our. It's the Atlas V is a workhorse vehicle, or has historically been a workhorse vehicle. But there has been this national security concern. Can you really afford to believe that you can trust things flying on a Russian engine vehicle? And there's been substantial discussions or arguments about this from various companies, you know, saying, well, we don't need to do that. We have alternatives out there. And we have other people who are saying we don't have enough alternatives out there to retire the RD-180.
Right. So I think the Russia experience speaks to the need for private industry in outer space now. And that's not looking so much in the into the future, but in the present. You know, we do rely on the Russians at this very moment to fly our astronauts to the International Space Station. In 2 years or so, a year or 2 years, we won't need to anymore because SpaceX and then Boeing will be flying through a contract with NASA astronauts to the International Space Station on their rockets and their spacecraft. And so the Russia experience has taught us, if anything, in my opinion, that domestic American industry, you know, us, can fill the gaps that we're currently relying on foreign countries to fill. And that moving forward, maybe we won't need to be so reliant on a Russia.
And actually, there's strong arguments to be made that we're not as reliant as we think we are, because we've had, in the last 3 or 4 years, a number of Russian launch accidents. And I mean, there was the this is a few years ago, but we had the loss of a Progress rocket going to ISS. There was 3 or 4 major. They're called Proton rockets. They're kind of the big rocket. Those were lost. There was a space probe they lost. So it's one of those things that looks impressive, but when you start digging into it, the insurance costs are actually pretty harsh if you were to do your own satellite on a Russian rocket.
Right.
So.
Looking ahead, I'd love to give some listeners tips on how they can get involved if they're super interested in this issue, what they should be reading. You guys are involved with the Space Frontier Foundation, so where should we point our nerdy listeners who just love this topic?
Do you want to give the plug or do you want me to give the
clip? Absolutely. Well, for listeners who are interested, first and foremost, the Space Frontier Foundation is a wonderful resource, and we're a great way for people to get involved. We focus mostly on the new space contingent of companies, that is the new players on the block. But we believe strongly in a future in which humanity lives and works in space, right?
And that all of it, or we'll still have some people on Earth?
Well, you can have your vision of either Star Trek or Star Wars or
Interstellar.
Exactly. Well, we can have the religious debate about which is the best series.
Well, but to that, the foundation isn't only just about spreading humanity to the stars, but taking the learning experience and the benefit of going to the stars and applying it back on Earth. Because through using space, we improve things back here at home.
Yeah.
And so we have conferences, we do policy work, we have email blasts, we do newsletters. It's a great way to get involved, to meet good people in the industry, to learn a ton, and to have fun. It's a great team.
And the other thing, is you're not required to be the expert in the field. You can, you know, if your interest is in spreading the message at a very high level, there's things to do in the foundation for that. If you want to dive into the policy and, you know, you want to go knock on doors for Congress, that's something else we work on. If you are interested in, hell, if you want to start your own space company, we have a lot of people who are actively working on that kind of stuff, you know, and you'll have people who come to our conference. Another plug for the New Space Conference we're having in 2 weeks. Is it 2 weeks now?
It's 2 weeks in Seattle, Washington. June 21st to 23rd.
People will come there and they'll have, oh, I have an idea for a company. Before you know it, there's been companies that have literally grown out of discussions at New Space.
Mm-hmm. Well, listeners, if you're interested, check out the Space Frontier Foundation. This will be the first of many episodes I do with the fine folks at SFF on this awesome topic.
Absolutely. And if you don't mind, you can find us at spacefrontier.org. So just come onto our website and learn everything about
us. And check them out on Twitter and Facebook, and we'll link to that website in the show notes for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining me, gentlemen. My guests have been Aaron Osterley and Cody Knipfer of the Space Frontier Foundation.
Thank you so much.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Send us an email. Tell us what you think of the show at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app. Please leave us a review because we'll help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.